Hey, what is going on, Los Angeles? It's J.Dot, T.Dot, and once again, I hope that you are very well on this December 15th, 2023. Isabel Jurado has raised more than $150,000 for her campaign for Council District 14 on the East Side, and you have to hear all about it. Between now and about February 5th, when ballots get to mailboxes for the March 5th primary, it's just about 50 days. And so we get into that, as well as what her plan for millions in discretionary funding through CD14 shall be, and so much more. If you are not already following the show or subscribed, please do hit that follow / subscribe button ASAP. Okay, with that said, thank you very much once again to Isabel Jurado and her team. And until the next time, stay vigilant and stay tuned. It's J.Dot, T.Dot, out with more soon. It's Jimbo times. Well, Isabel Jurado, thank you so very much for joining me for this special edition of JT the LA Storyteller podcast. I really want to speak with you because the election season is quickly coming up, even though it's the holidays now. And I think folks need to become familiar with your name all across the city of LA, including in CD14, but also wherever allies and supporters are to be found. So I really want to thank you for joining me today. And how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk to you on a podcast.
Yes, and thank you so much for the ube bulile and teaching me a little bit of Tagalog this AM.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to ask you, first of all, what Council District 14 is, as in what neighborhoods make up CD 14, and then I want to ask you about what led you to declare a candidacy for this race coming up as soon as March 5th, but well before then too, because of mail-in ballots.
Yeah, the election day is March 5th, but ballots drop February 5th, so that's like what, 41 days out.
Yeah.
City Council, Los Angeles City Council District 14 includes Eagle Rock, Highland Park, El Sereno, Boyle Heights, you know, downtown LA has Little Tokyo, Arts District, Skid Row, Central City, South Park. So it's like the Northeast dips a little down into El Sereno, Boyle Heights, and then sweeps downtown, except for LA Live. And so it's a really big district with a lot of different interests if you just listen to all these neighborhoods, right? And it's largely working class. 70% of the district, I think, are renters. And it's mostly, you know, multifamily homes. And it's a really a working class district, right? Like around 90% of the district makes $100,000 or less. And I want to say like almost like 39% make less than 50K. And so it's really working class, multiracial communities that live throughout the district.
And you actually grew up in the Highland Park neighborhood, which you've noted. You even went to Franklin High. So it's
Oh, no, I didn't go to Franklin.
Where did you go?
I actually went. I'm a Catholic school girl.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So I went to Immaculate Heart.
I mean, so many Catholic communities out in LA, including folks who went to private Catholic high schools.
Yeah.
So I think it allows you to relate quite a bit to folks who had a similar trajectory for their K through 12 education out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I still had friends that went to public school around here, but I went to St. Ignatius off Monte Vista. And then my cousin who grew up in Echo Park was like, I'm going to Immaculate Heart High School. And so because I idolized her, I followed her there.
Immaculate Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've definitely heard that before.
Yeah.
So
it was far.
Well, a lot of folks were bussed out of their communities because local schools were regarded, and to a great extent, are still seen as underinvested in, which is certainly true.
Yeah. So. Yeah. My parents definitely thought that was true. And especially as immigrants coming to LA, their narratives were based on what they saw on the television. And they felt that Highland Park wasn't a safe place. And to a certain extent, it wasn't when I was growing up here. Right. You know, our security was always my dad, and it still is, my dad's primary concern. And so that and my belief in God. Right. So they were just like, okay, well, you need to go to private school. So we went to one, and it was like, you know, two blocks away from my Lola, my grandma's house. And so, you know, it was convenient for them too, to pick me up.
Yeah. Wow. Shout out to Lola.
I know. Yeah. With her little umbrella. Always after school, I was so embarrassed because I'd be like, why does my grandma have an umbrella? It's not raining. But she's like, I don't want to get dark.
Yeah. I totally see it. Now, you mentioned, or we mentioned, that we're in the Highland Park neighborhood. Mm-hmm. For someone who, say, voted for Eunices Hernandez, mm-hmm, just a little over a year back, they might ask, how is it that you're running for CD 14 while Eunices Hernandez, who reps CD 1, is the rep for Highland Park? Is it that the map is split up somewhere? Is, mm-hmm, it that Highland Park is divided in two somewhere?
Yeah, Highland Park is divided in two, and York is the kind of the dividing line. And so north of York is where I live. It's like the Garbanza area, and that's CD 14. And then south of York is Eunices Hernandez's district. And so when I talk to her, I'm like, she's like my sister. We grew up in Highland Park at the same time, you know, on the different sides of it. And we saw what took root in our communities, the gentrification take hold. And that's partially of why we've become radicalized and served our community, to prevent us from being, you know, over policed or, you know, being sold out or pushed out. And so she and I just share the same, like, lived experience, and really want to help Highland Park thrive, you know, and keep our community safe, and, you know, don't lose our people, you know?
Right, right. And so I take it that this is a part of what led you to declare your candidacy for this race. I mean, when is it that, mm-hmm, that you had this seminal moment, this moment of clarity where you said, I think I need to get my name in the race, because, mm-hmm, if not, we stand to lose this community?
Right. Yeah. I think it was like about a year ago. I think I filed officially like December 27th, but we didn't really launch our campaign until August. But it was really after the tapes, right? But it was like a culmination of like things, right? Living in Highland Park, being a daughter of undocumented immigrants, and was like a single teen mom that was on food stamps. Like, I'm a daughter of this district, and I had to struggle here to become an attorney from UCLA. But, you know, I knew how hard my family worked to get where we are, and I just felt betrayed by this kind of leadership, especially when I know those economic inequalities that I saw growing up had deepened so much, right? As an eviction defense attorney, I was seeing people fall into homelessness. I was seeing small businesses go out of business, and majority of them were minority owned, and I was so frustrated with the status quo. And then also, on top of that, you know, during the pandemic, you know, we had the George Floyd, may rest in peace, a racial reckoning that we were promised and weren't delivered. And so by the time the tapes came out, I was like, this is what we have to show for. This is our leadership in the self-proclaimed progressive city, in a most progressive city in America, right? The second largest city council. When we make something pass and our leadership says something in city council here in LA, it has an effect on the rest of the nation. And I was like, we need leadership that actually embodies our community when the doors are open and when the doors are closed. And so, you know, for me, from all that anger and frustration, I was like, it drove me into action and wanting to be like, well, what can I do? You know, with the privileges I've been afforded because of this community, it was like, okay, I'll do this. I'll put my hand in the ring. And so, you know, I talked to a couple of folks. They're like, yeah, you seem good. And like, you know, a year later, you know, staffed up, have a campaign manager, like all these things I'm learning on the fly and getting all this momentum with, like, you know, whenever we throw in an event, there's always hundreds of people. And I'm always worried that nobody's going to show up. And yet the community is showing up and showing out because they want a change, and they're yearning for it.
And to be sure, when you are engaging with the community on the ground, specifically through door knocking, what is their sense of city council or city hall? Is it just politics as usual? Is that what you are seeing or hearing?
Kind of, you know, I'm uncovering a lot of hopelessness and like people just being jaded. Like this district in particular has had decades of poor leadership, right? We currently have a council member who's refusing to resign. The one before that, we liked him. He was homegrown, and yet he ended up being a crook. And so we just felt lied to our face, you know? And then the one before that moved into the district, told us he wasn't going to leave us to become mayor, and then 2 months after being elected was already running for mayor, you know? And then the council member before that had to resign in disgrace because for other corruption, right? We have severe abandonment issues when it comes to our council members. And so when we go to the doors and there are people, some people don't know who their council member is, and that's valid, right? But other folks that do just are like, man, I just want someone who's honest, who's reliable, who will answer my call. And I'm just like, wow, we're asking for the bare minimum, right? We just want someone to do their job and to stay to do this job. And, you know, for me, I'm like, I'm from this community. I'm for this community. I could have gone and done that, you know, sexy corporate job as an attorney. And I didn't. And my parents were disappointed. right. But I did it because I was like, look, all these lived experience that I've had, my dad and my mom have had, I was like seeking to remedy it so other folks didn't have to go through that. And, you know, serving my community. So for me, when I come out these doors, I'm just like, man, I just want to be a public servant. Like, I want to put that at the center of what it means to be a council member and not disgrace or, you know, scandal. I'm just like, I just want to do my job and like clean the streets. Yo.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. And especially speaking of lived experience and what your background with this community has looked like over the course of your career, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how serving as an attorney, mm-hmm. a defense attorney, a tenants' rights attorney mm-hmm. for folks has prepped you for life at LA City Hall if elected this upcoming year.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been on the front lines of the failed policies of our current elected officials, whether they're state assembly members or they're council members. Like, you know, I stood shoulder to shoulder with tenants when they were getting evicted during COVID when it was supposed to be illegal, right? I literally put my 5-foot little body on the line to defend my, they were like taller tenants. But, you know, from like these goons that were trying to forcibly evict them, right? And I only had like a tiny little business card to be like, look, I'm actually an attorney to try to like really defend them, right? I'm the only attorney that's been in the courtrooms to defend tenants at the same time and also been, you know, at the front lines of creating social housing that we keep talking about in the city, right? And so I think with those experiences, I actually have a bold, creative, fresh approach to housing, which we need because what we're doing is obviously not working or not enough.
Maybe you can say a little bit about what the front line on social housing has looked like in LA, where it's been sorely missing, but where increasingly more people are looking towards this as another solution, another potential step towards a solution, since it's going to be such a multi-pronged effort.
Yeah, I love that you highlight that, right? Because it's like, this is not the silver bullet, but we need to have more options, right? And so for those, like social housing means, you know, right now, affordable housing, when it's built, it only targets very low or low income people. But as we know, like a single adult in Los Angeles that makes $70,000 a year is considered low income, right? So even middle wage earning Angelenos can't afford rent here in LA. So we need to develop like mixed income housing for folks through social housing. And so as an attorney, I've worked with community land trusts, which are nonprofits and neighborhoods that make sure to take buy back land, make sure it's permanently affordable, and keep it in their communities and form housing cooperatives where it gives tenants a pathway to home ownership that they may never have had before, right? So that's the kind of projects that I've worked on in LA and want to make sure that's like a baseline option for folks. And you can do that, City Council. You set the baselines, whereas what I've been doing is like the spot problem solving, you know, here and there. But as council member, you could really be like, well, this is part of the standards of what we expect people to actually do. And frankly, we used a creative tax measure, you know, ULA, to fund these projects, and it's explicit. And so we can do these things. We just need people with the political will and courage to do so.
Yeah, and especially because you mentioned community land trust, we're in CD 14. Mm-hmm. I think of the El Sereno Community Land Trust mm-hmm. and the Reclaiming Our Homes effort. And so I imagine that you've been in conversation with folks there over the last couple of years because they have been trying years. They mm-hmm. have been very difficult years. I remember the campaign over the Thanksgiving season when folks were forcibly removed from homes that were empty prior to their making use of them as families in need.
Yeah. I mean, I've worked with the Reclaimers. I've worked with El Sereno Community Land Trust. I mean, for me, it just like it seems awful that these folks that have created, you know, they saw an unused, housing option for them, used it, and then created the political momentum for it to actually be developed as affordable housing for unhoused people. And yet they're being evicted for doing that, right? And so I was working with the Reclaimers in El Sereno to form a housing cooperative. They formed the El Sereno Housing Justice Cooperative to buy back those buildings so that they can live in there and so that the people that live there can have a just transition, right? So that they can stay in the communities that they become a part of. And we don't lose them as well. Like, how are we going to solve the homelessness crisis if we develop affordable housing by making people houseless?
Yeah, absolutely. And with respect to that, I believe the El Sereno Community Land Trust and the Reclaiming Our Homes effort is now fundraising. Mm-hmm. So for those angel philanthropists out there who are looking to support a cause for housing, immediate and imminent housing mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. Just want to plug them slightly and note that they're fundraising now to reclaim some of these homes and keep them mm-hmm. within the community.
Yeah, please donate to Reclaim Our Homes. You know, your money will go to help them buy, but also some of the lived expenses of sometimes, you know, the utilities and other things like that. And I love the advocacy that the Reclaimers do even outside of their own project, right? They're out there for renters. They're out there for racial justice. They're really fighting the fight in coalition with people and showing up. And because this is what that experience has taught them. And I love it. Or they're teaching us, actually, you know?
Now, because we mentioned the Reclaimers being forcibly removed, I think a lot about this recent conversation with Councilmember Hernandez, where she pointed out that actually CD14 has the highest number of eviction filings mm-hmm. out of all the council districts. I was really taken aback by that, but I was not shocked, especially given downtown LA mm-hmm. and the Boyle Heights area. So mm-hmm. I'm curious about your thoughts on this statistic and what can be done in the days ahead.
Yeah, in the days ahead, man, you know, I continue my advocacy as a housing rights advocate, but we really need to enhance renter protections, right? Only 90% of landlords go to court with an attorney, but only 10% of tenants do. And when a tenant doesn't answer or have an attorney to help them through that legal process, sometimes they end up in a default judgment, which means they could be, you know, they're out of a house in like a month or so. And so passing a right to counsel is super important. The second one is also like, there's sometimes constructive evictions that happen, like by landlords just leaving the apartment really, really crappy. Eventually, after a while, like, you don't want to live in a place with a wet ceiling that's never going to get fixed. And the tenant actually self-evicts. But one of the most recent interactions I had while our canvassers and I followed up were door knocking, is that there's this 71-year-old neighbor of mine who's on a fixed income with disability. He's making around $980 or something, but his rent is $650, right?
Wow.
And then the city council just passed that rent increase of like four to six. And so for him, what is he going to do? Yeah. And he's lived in there for like, what, 16 years? Like, we need to save our seniors. And our council member, current one, voted for that. Like, what are you going to tell me about my neighbor who's 71 years old, probably can't go back to work because of his disability, and a myriad of other, you know, issues with hiring? Where is he going to go?
Yeah, and I mean, I think about the way that, especially because this resumes in February, as well as back rent, along with back rent that is owed, folks are anticipating, as you have noted, an eviction tsunami. And so I think it's such a critical time for leadership, elected leadership. But when folks see more and more people on the street, I think going back to being jaded, going back to being exhausted, really, with the political tragedy that we're staring at, I think is really a tough moment for those of us in the advocacy space and those of us who are trying to encourage more people to engage rather than doing the opposite and tuning out, which I think is what a moneyed class wants of hardworking communities that are already just at the edge.
Absolutely. Like, when you're in survival mode, what do you have to think about other extra things? Or if you're already comfortable, then it breeds complacency and be like, well, that's not my problem, you know? But, you know, I refuse to subscribe to the ideology. I believe in radical hope, right? And I also think that the people, right, that have gone through it, that are going through it, that are struggling, are actually, you know, the most creative people that we know, right? Like, you know, they are the most creative people that we know, because those that have been going through struggles in order to survive, right, they have to imagine systems for themselves to be able to be successful and to continually live. And so they create these alternate modalities that don't exist in our systems as they are, right? And I go back to, like, okay, businesses excluded Black people, right? And so Black folks were actually the first innovators of cooperatives. Cooperative businesses, where there's like a basically the businessification of like a mutual aid group so that we can all benefit from it to get resources and share, right? In other words, that is a corporation, right? But that's the kind of creative thinking that our communities already do in the struggle. And that, to me, gives me radical hope. And I'm like, look, I'm not even trying to go in there with all these like crazy new ideas. I just want to lift up the ideas and the systems we already have and make sure that we make it easier for people to live. Because our systems, as we all know, the law and economy at inception in America was designed against people of color and racial injustice, and to keep capital for the few. And look, I'm as a lawyer, I've been refusing that and try to think creatively to work inside that system to make it actually serve the masses of people, right?
Absolutely. And going back to design and the way that design is at times, well, especially in our city, contradictory, we, of course, have thought about the rent and the average rent, or the median rent, versus what the median income in Los Angeles is. And we've seen that there's a huge inconsistency. I've seen folks note that given the price of a two-bedroom apartment where median rent is over $2,000, the median income should be about $42 an hour. The median wage should be about $42 an hour.
Right.
And so we're a long way out, actually. But it's a huge part of how, as you're saying, if we don't have officials or elected representatives who understand and can see these facts on the grounds for themselves, then naturally we're just going to keep getting the same results, because there's a huge disconnect, a serious gap between what the reality on the ground looks like for folks and what the moneyed class is claiming they're in need of, actually.
Right. I mean, once you're in your ivory tower, you're complacent. Maybe you're making $220,000, which to me seems like gobs of money as a council member to be making, right? I'm like, you're not in touch with what's happening on the ground and in communities. And the urgency is not there, right? Like, you don't think it's that big of a problem. But, you know, that's why I'm espousing on this campaign, and even when in office, and I think Councilmember Hernandez also does this, right? Co-governance, right? The people that we're bringing to the table are the people that raised us and we've worked in community with. They're community members, nonprofits, the people on the front lines of these issues, and really centering the folks we're talking about in policymaking. Because let's face it, our current council members, the ones and elected officials that already govern on these issues, that's not who they have at the table with them. They got corporations, developers, big oil, police, apartment associations with them that are deciding and writing all these laws for them. And that's just not the people that I'm going to work with, right? I'm going to work with my community and the people most affected by these issues and center them in the policy making, which I think is really missing.
Well, and you've already said that you're not taking any PAC money. You're not taking any money from wealthy corporations out there. You have a people-led campaign, a people-powered campaign, which does set you apart from a number of other candidates on this trail.
Yeah, you know, I think today I'm coming off the heels of a wonderful fundraiser that my team just knocked it out of the park for, and also was super fun. Shout out to all the queens that came to Isabel, and the kings too, of course, but you know, we've been able to raise $150,000 with no corporate PAC, no corporations, no big oil, big pharma, no prison industrial complex money. That's all grassroots, right? And, you know, we really are powered by the people, whereas these other folks that are on, that are running, that are elected officials, they're like, I'm progressive. I am the climate champion. And yet they're accepting like big oil money or hydrogen money. And then there's like, there's another one that's like, I'm a renter's champion, right? And then you look and like, why is AGLA and all of these big real estate development firms funding your campaign? Then what are you really doing? Like, who are you serving?
Now, earlier you mentioned Measure ULA, which so many different advocates in the city are excited about for sure. But another part of what I found to be really illuminating with Councilmember Hernandez recently was that she noted CD14 actually has millions of dollars in discretionary funding. So discretionary funding just means here's a lot of surplus.
Yes.
What do we do with it? Let's say it's December 2024 or January 2025, and you're in office. What do you do with millions of dollars right away in CD14? Hey, Los Angeles. I hope you're enjoying this conversation as much as I am. I just want to take a moment to invite you to my Patreon channel, which supports JT the LA Storyteller podcast in more ways than one, and which also provides just a little more from each convo. And of course, this is because it takes a little bit of work to put this podcast together, including research and reaching out to folks and scheduling things, and then studio time, editing time, finally publishing, and then a little bit of marketing time. And the Patreon channel is just the best way to support all of that, to support independent storytelling in LA by JT the LA Storyteller. So I would love your support, and I can give you my word that it's going to be more than worth it. Now, back to the show.
Yo, shoot, that's the dream. You know, that's what we're working towards. It would be first things first is attacking our homelessness crisis, right? We have the ability. We would have the ability to create community resource hubs, which are a one-stop shop where unhoused neighbors can take a bath, have a meal, go to sleep without being policed, and also have wraparound services available to them. Meet with a housing navigator, see a medic that can treat their physical or their mental ailments, right? Because right now, when you go to a shelter, you have to be clean before you get in, right? And then once you get in, it's not like you see a doctor or a housing navigator. This is just did, right? And what are the other options? You stay on the street, get criminalized or swept away. And so having those places where folks can get all their needs met so that they become housing ready when housing is available. Like, I don't know about you, but I hate having to go to AT&T to fix something with my phone and then having to go to the doctor and then going to the dentist. Like all of these things, if you don't have a car, you don't have a phone, and you have to bring all your stuff with you all the time, can be so cumbersome. And so really centering our unhoused communities in this process, that would be number one. Number two would be like, you know, setting aside funding so that communities can buy back real estate in their neighborhoods to protect our renters from displacement. And also protecting our legacy small businesses, especially in neighborhoods like Boyle Heights, where businesses are being evicted, they're being redeveloped, or worse, you know, I don't know if it's worse actually, but it's just as bad, right? Is when they evict small businesses and just leave it vacant for years, right? And so, you know, providing funding for these groups and community land trusts to be able to do that. The county already launched a pilot program to fund social housing projects with these community land trusts. And so the city should be able to match that effort because we've seen the proof of concept and its success, right? And now we need to we need to go do it. Like, we don't need to study. We just need to go do it.
Now, let's say we're on the campaign trail. Let's say that you are door knocking somewhere. You mentioned in particular the one-stop resource center for folks who lack shelter. Mm-hmm. What do you say to the renter who's out there who replies to you that, you know what, they work hard and mm-hmm. they don't know why this other community in their eyes is getting special treatment mm-hmm. when as longtime renters, longtime community members, they've kind of just done their part, but have still somehow been left behind. What do we say to that?
Yeah, I hear that. I do hear that at the doors. I hear that, you know, sometimes when I talk to folks, you know, propertied or not, you know, that is something that I do hear on the ground. And when I think about it, I'm just like, look, I'm here to help preserve and maintain and create affordable housing options. I'm here so that I can enhance your renter protections. And look, I know that times are tough, but like, I would have voted to continue the rent freeze while you're still recovering from your COVID debt. And with those discretionary funds, if I could create a rental assistance program for CD14 residents that are still recovering from COVID-19, which I don't know about you, but like, I have people that I know that are still it's COVID season again, right? And so if I could do that with my discretionary fund, setting that aside to help those folks out that are still just trying to catch up, right? That would be something that I'd tell them. And you know, at the end of the day, I think repealing Costa Hawkins would be a huge improvement for renters and being able for the city of LA to expand rent control and start to think about taxing vacancy rates in buildings. Because we know that there are a lot of buildings here in LA that are just empty and could house our unhoused community. Right. And that could also, you know, when you repeal Costa Hawkins, we'd be able to stabilize the rent throughout the city because we'd have more expensive rent control so that we wouldn't have rent going up, you know, every single year, 10% every single year. And just like in this endless rat race to pay our housing when our rents are not going up that high every single year.
Yeah. And I actually think that one note I've heard you mention is that working class people actually have a lot more in common with folks who are unsheltered or unhoused out there than they do with millionaires and billionaires out there who are seeking to just redevelop these neighborhoods. So there's a lot of common ground, actually, even though they might seem to occupy different versions of the city, which is true up to a point, but there's still an inherent mm-hmm. connection to working people's struggle there.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking about this yesterday. I'm like, yeah, it's kind of like the corporate elite versus the working class people. The way that we suffer, I mean, the ways that we suffer, like, the conditions in which we suffer are different, right? But the suffering all the same, right? We're just being crushed by these oppressive forces of like, it's too expensive to buy food, or I have to work so much that, you know, just to afford my basic needs that I can't, you know, I can't find joy. I don't have time, free time to just like chill and hang out and like, you know, find joy. And so I think it's just like in all of these communities, that is the thing, that like life is so crushing and stressful. They can't actually live, you know, like the phrase, let me live is like the thing. And for me, it's like policies that we're passing, government policies that we're passing. I think David Kim says that is like needs to be like life-giving policies. At the root of our policies, we should be like, what is this going to do to help people live, right? That should be at the heart of every single policy that we're doing, not like, you know, like these mid-level steps at prevention that just like actually at the end of the day cost people lives. Like, do we need cops on the street to do traffic stops? How is that saving lives? Let's have unarmed LADOT officers actually conduct a traffic ticket so that, you know, you don't have to deal with an armed officer that could lead to a violent interaction, you know? I think those are the ways that we can start thinking about, like, we can keep people alive and, you know, preventable deaths are within the realm of what the city of LA could be doing. But I think we need to reframe our philosophies when we develop, you know, these policies, even at the city level.
And going back into particulars for a little bit, we did mention Boyle Heights just a moment ago, and recently there was a committee meeting, the Planning and Land Use Management Committee at LA City Hall, or the PLUM Committee, as it's also known. They heard arguments from local businesses in the Boyle Heights area opposed to Chow Development's complete eviction and redevelopment of this space for 50 units, five of which would be for low-income folks, and they have essentially stalled that process through. Now, for somebody who is witnessing this and who says, you know what, you have spoken about housing and the needs for housing. Here's a developer who is creating housing, yes, predominantly for the market rate, but we need more market rate units too. How is it that preventing this is going to get us out of the crisis? What do we say to those folks?
I mean, always when it comes to development, we got to listen to the communities, right? And much respect to Boyle Heights. Boyle Heights is an organized community with just like a beautiful history of resistance and culture. And you don't want to lose that, right? And that's what this community is fighting for. And for me, when folks say like, well, we need to, why are you stopping this? We're building more market rate housing to solve the housing crisis. I'm like, why is that always the refrain to every single thing, right? Then every single argument's always like, we have to build more market rate, market rate. But where's the conversation? Like, oh, we're going to build market rate and then have five very low income houses. And we're going to do that every single time. So like in three projects, we'll just get 15 like low income housing when we know there's so, when we're in a rent city, renter city, that's rent burdened, we're going to solve it by like five units at a time. And not only that, evicting a whole family that has been there for 30 years. This is just like, my philosophy is development without displacement, right? Like, you want to redevelop this building to have small businesses and luxury units. Like, sometimes these developments don't make sense when it's like, I want to rebuild this and I want to have the same kind of shops, but I want to replace the coffee shop with a Starbucks. And I was like, well, this coffee shop's already here. It's still good. It's still working. The community loves it and they can afford it, you know? And so to me, these policies where folks are just saying like, we need to build market rate seem to be like really short-sighted, shallow answers, right? Because at the end of the day, the Chow Corporation is going to evict all of these small businesses and like is a family as well, right? And like someone who's like an elderly person that, but for being able to live here for that long, is probably, since they're losing their business and they're losing their home and they're 70 years old, how are they going to re-enter the renter market? How are they going to re-enter, you know, small businesses and employment? Like, it comes at such a high cost of human life, right? For this argument of like market rate development. So for me, you know, there's a concept that I try to adapt to housing that exists in workers and employment, right, when it comes to climate change. And it's called like just transition. So when we transition from fossil fuel to cleaner energies, we guarantee employment for workers and union jobs so that, you know, we don't lose people whose whole livelihood has been working, you know, on an oil rig and having to transition to this new world and like figure it out and still be able to support their family and pay the mortgage that maybe they still have. And for me, I think that's crucial for development is like, how can we ensure a just transition for the current residents that live there, right? So we don't lose them.
Right. And I think what I also hear in that sort of response to a proposed development that is ultimately stalled because of the community's input is a kind of jadedness, as we were saying earlier, and a sort of resignation to the moneyed class's way and to development's way, because maybe folks who are seeing the city of LA go down this path of so much market rate housing everywhere, maybe they figure that this is just the way that it goes, that this is what money does, and that working people ultimately don't have a voice and that they should just adapt or move on. I hear a little bit of that in that sort of response to this kind of event.
Yeah, I mean, I refuse that. And I know Boyle Heights does because the whole coalitions, you know, CPC, that's Community Power Collective, and Rearte, that's there, that are working against them. They refuse. Like Boyle Heights has resisted gentrification because of the strength of this community and their, you know, investment in each other and themselves. And so, you know, for me, like this community is inspiring. Right. And that's the kind of work that I want to uplift as a council member, like lend my influence and power, because council members get to, through their land use power, decide what gets built in the community or not, or they can make it very difficult for someone to build something. Right. And they can also like shout out on the rooftops and the horn of when like public comment is going to have, instead of hiding it in a little square where nobody's going to listen to. And so I would lend my voice for the community in this process about this development to make sure there isn't displacement, so we can resist that corporate class and corporatization of our neighborhoods, especially ones with rich culture, rich history. Like, we don't want Boyle Heights to be a boring Walmart town or have that Starship development over there, you know?
So if you are on the Plum Committee in 2024 or 2025, once those committee assignments start going out, what is your agenda? What is a high priority on your plate with respect to planning and land use in CD14?
I mean, for me, okay, so I have this cake analogy. Come with me.
Let's go.
So the way that I think about development, I think the way that our development process goes is all wrong, right? The community, you know, especially the way that we engage communities. And so it's like baking a cake. And the community is often brought in when it's time to decide what the sprinkles are on the cake. Whereas I think the community should be brought in when we're talking about the ingredients in the cake, right? And so these developments do have a public process as part of it. And it's usually at the tail end and you have to give a notice, but the notice is usually not in a different language. And it's like, maybe it's only online, or maybe it's this flimsy little sign where nobody really sees it, right? And so I would make sure, as part of my commitment to co-governance, to be like, this is coming up on the calendar, and have a meeting with the community to be like, what do you think about this? What do you want? What are the priorities in bringing them in, instead of it being this like opaque, hidden process that, you know, you just come out and like, this is it. Isn't it great? This is a beautiful cake.
That, like, you get a say for when it's 95% of the way there.
Right. It's like a, what is it? It's a formal inclusion in the process, but it's not meaningful, right? It's like, I'm going through the motions and I'm inviting you to have an opinion, but your opinion really doesn't mean anything by this point.
And I think you really have a sense ultimately of land and stewardship and how we steward over land rather than simply own it. I think also a part of your roots as a Pilipina, someone with intimate ties to migration and displacement and even war on the people for their land. I think all of these things ultimately inform your sense of how we will conduct this in Los Angeles going forward, which I think is an entryway for a lot of folks out there, because this is a migrant city, among other things. Folks from all kinds of diaspora know that there's this existing relation between not an ownership of land, but stewardship and land.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I was thinking about, you know, all the things that are happening in the world. I think about, I am a daughter in the Filipino diaspora. My parents came to America because of authoritarian regime that created, that was sponsored by the United States, that created a lack of economic opportunities for my mom, who grew up dirt poor, and my dad, who had to, like, you know, followed her without his papers to come to America. And so they've been displaced by their home because of capitalism and violence and oppression. And that's why they're here. And growing up in Highland Park and seeing that happen in my neighborhood with people being displaced, that has become, I didn't realize it until like a couple years ago, that's been such a core part of my like identity and emotional, like emotional drive and passion comes from this source of like, we have been displaced and not wanting to see that happen to our communities. And how do we fight that? And like, when I look at the world, I'm just like, we have enough land. We have enough water. We actually have enough resources to live, and we need to stop. You know, the youth are sounding the alarm. Shout out to Youth Climate Strike and the Youth Interest Pact and folks that are on the front lines of climate change, because, you know, we have enough in this world. If we stop destroying it, right, we could have enough land to house everyone and water and clean air, but we keep not taking care of the land. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, just to be sure, as I was on my way over here in the Highland Park neighborhood, I just glanced over to see if these tiny homes off or just adjacent to the 110 were still there. They are.
Yep.
But I think it would be great if you could shed a little bit of light on how tiny homes serve as a temporary solution for housing for those folks who may be out there thinking, hey, like, it's been built. There's a place for all of these unsheltered folks, there it is. Maybe you can shed some light on how it actually functions and how it's not as simple as, well, now that it's built, it is housing.
Yeah, it's not housing, right? It's temporary, right? It's better than a tent, but it's not housing. They're sheds. I kept calling them sheds. I call them tiny sheds. But yeah, they're temporary. And so this is what the process actually looks like. When you're unhoused and you have to move into the tiny sheds, tiny homes, and you, like, let me take it all the way back. You're an unhoused person that has lived on the street. You have to bring all of your belongings everywhere with you because they might get stolen. Even a blanket, you know, even something as simple as blanket or clothing is readily stolen, right? So you have all your possessions that you have in the world, and you always have them with you, and you've accumulated it over time because these are the resources you need in order to live or survive, or you have emotional attachments too, because you're like a turtle. That's all you have. You know, for folks at our house, think about moving and how when you accumulate all that stuff, when you have to deal with it, right? So when you go into tiny sheds, then you have to risk losing all of your stuff or a lot of it in order to fit the shed. And those are some things that maybe you have emotional memories with or things like that, especially if you're like, live alone, you're mentally unwell. Like, you have these attachment to the thing. So first, you got to get rid of all your stuff, right? So then let's say you did get rid of all your stuff, and then you go into the tiny homes. It's only supposed to be a temporary solution to live in a small space for that long of a time. Now, if you're a woman and you need to go to the bathroom in the evening, you can't. You have to walk through the area in order to go to the bathroom. You don't have a bathroom in your room. And doing that at night is obviously something that's uncomfortable, can be dangerous, and doesn't feel safe. And so it's not welcoming. It is shelter, but even when it rains, sometimes, you know, it'll leak in there. And then after a couple months, like, look, you're only supposed to be there for 3 months. So then after a couple months, you're going to have to leave, right? And the housing is not being built fast enough that there is a transition point after 3 months. So this person ends up going back on the street with less of their stuff. And so at that point, it's like, why would I want to move in there in the first place, right? Like, you're going to go inside, lose half your things, and then go back on the street. Like, I know people, I just try to put it in the perspective of house people so you can actually, like, feel and understand, like, do you want to move and lose your stuff? Like, do you want to keep moving every 3 months? I think house people would not want to do that. And that is so cumbersome and you lose a lot of things. And for unhoused people, it just could make it even harder for them to find housing. Because what if they lose their driver's license or, you know, the document with their legal papers? Like when I was an attorney doing this holistic services, I was doing like expungement of like, you know, driving infractions. And like those are little things that if they don't have the legal papers, then it takes even longer for them to resolve these issues so they can get a driver's license so that they can apply for housing and then they can wait to get in housing, right? And so I think tiny homes are the bare minimum of what we can do. They're not the end all be all. And in fact, we need to start investing in temporary housing solutions for people that can last them 3 to 5 years, right? I was talking to Gary Blasey, who's like a UCLA, you know, housing researcher and expert and like contributor in our field. And he was telling me about Life Arc in El Monte, which is basically, you know, a one bedroom and it comes with its own, it's bigger than the tiny homes and it has its own bathroom and folks can live there from 3 to 5 years, right? And he's just like, some people are like, this is the best housing I've ever had. And so I think we need to start investing in that solution, right? So we can, while we still figure out how to build affordable housing that's permanent and resolve our homelessness crisis.
Again, as we said, it's multi-pronged. It's going to take so many different layers, so many different moving parts, including dysfunctional aspects of how city government has operated so far, just as you said, in this very last minute style of responding to the crises on our hands that have accumulated over many years, over many decades, over a long time struggle. I think also as well about Filipino communities or Filipinx communities getting out to mm-hmm. Southern California way back in the early days of the city mm-hmm. and its agricultural promise and the way that as farm workers, mm-hmm. they also had violence inflicted upon them for their efforts to unionize, for any attempt to organize alongside their counterparts on this side. And so it goes back quite a long way, actually, to make this call towards our communities once again mm-hmm. to reclaim what is owed or what is in order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's for all of us, right? Yeah. We're fighting for all of us. Yeah. And like Filipinos have always been in the struggle and in coalition. And like as an Asian American, I'm not going to be used as a racial wedge against my folks that are working class. I'm here to lock arms with you. I always have to be in the struggle and to use my privilege to be the advocate and to, you know, give the mic to the communities and center them in our policies because this future is ours. Yeah. And the establishment, the democratic establishment, the corporate elite, they're scared of us. And I'm glad they're shaking in their boots because they know their time is coming.
Now, with respect to time, I really have appreciated your connecting with us this AM. We have just about 50 days before those ballots make their way to these mailboxes mm-hmm. and before folks get to cast their choice for CD14, among others. Now, what is your priority? What are you and your team doing between now and then just a little over 50 days?
Talking to voters, talking to people, listening. you know, we are going to get the, we need to get the word out, and we need the folks that want to join our movement to plug in, whether that means, you know, aside from voting, volunteering on our campaign, whether that means social media or, you know, knocking on doors or phone banking or text banking for us. We need folks to really plug in. And the other thing is, like, you know, no campaign can function without dollars. And like I said, we've raised $150,000, but we still need some more money to help pay for folks to continue to knock on doors when our volunteers can't. And at the end of the day, that does take money, you know? And so folks can donate. If you live in the city of LA, it matches at 6-1. It's pretty magical. And with that program, Councilmember Ramon and Hernandez were able to defeat incumbents who people thought were going to win. And now we have more women of color ever on city council. So I'm excited to go join them, but can't do it without folks chipping in. And then the last one is, like, amplify our message. If you see our story, you see our information, you like it, share it, tell your folks, tell your people, because this campaign is just this moment, but we're building part of the movement.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely one thing that Councilmember Hernandez emphasized during our conversation as well. It's not going to take just a single council member to turn this ship around, as she put it. It's going to take a coalition, mm-hmm. and this is an effort in extending that coalition, because I think what you've really highlighted today is that your interest is in uplifting the folks already doing the work, the folks who have been on the front lines, yourself included. But the picture is much larger. It's the picture that those moneyed classes and those special interests are shaking their boots about, as you noted.
Yeah, we need to build that progressive block. Once we build that block, we can make these bigger, bolder changes that we want to do. Right now, we're tinkering with change. You know, we keep studying about taking police officers off of traffic stops, right? But when we all know that we can take them off, right? So we got to stop tinkering with change. We should really be ready to transform it, and we need to have the right people on city council to be able to do that. I mean, think about it. Okay, I'm gonna do a sports thing. I'm not really sporty, but, like, you know, when they're trying to do the draft picks for a basketball team, and it's like, well, if you only got one superstar on the team, can they really make it to the playoffs? And it's like, no, you can't, right?
I think that's an analogy that a lot of folks in LA can definitely appreciate. So that's for sure. Isabel, what a morning with you. I know that you have a campaign trail to get to, so I really have to thank you for joining me on this installment of JT the LA Storyteller podcast. Where can people follow you? How can people write to you? Just give us that info and we're all set for the day.
Okay. Yes. My Instagram is Isabel Jurado LA. I think that's my handle on everything else. If you want to email me, you can email me at team@isabeljurado.com. And you can go to my website at isabeljurado.la.
Thank you so very much again, and have fun out there today.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
It's Jimbo times.